Okay, welcome everyone. Thank you for being here. I'm Roland Raja. I'm the director of the International Economy Program here at the Lowy Institute. And today it's my pleasure to be hosting today's In Conversation event with Dr. Nicholas Lardy, who is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics based in Washington, D.C., and one of the world's leading experts on the Chinese economy. Nick, welcome to the Lowy Institute. Nick has also just written an excellent new book. I have it here now, just had to grab it then, called The State Strikes Back, The End of Economic Reform in China, question mark, very important element to the title. So if you're interested in the Chinese economy, which I'm sure most of you are, then I do suggest you check out the book. It's an excellent read. I'm just gonna put this here. So Nick, thanks for coming and joining us here today. Yeah, I thought we might start off on a different note rather than go straight to the book and sort of ask you, you know, you've been looking at the Chinese economy for a very long time now. You know, what sort of motivated you to start looking at China all those years ago?
Well, it goes back to my family. My father was a professor of biochemistry at the University of Wisconsin, and from time to time among his postdoctoral fellows were some students from Taiwan. So when I was very young, I was hearing about Taiwan versus the mainland, and I got interested in that. Another step was I was very interested in domestic politics in the United States at that time, and particularly the 1960 Democratic primary. And later there was a well-known author who wrote, this was before television completely took over, wrote two books, one for the 60 campaign and one for the 64 campaign, called The Making of the President. And, you know, he traveled with the candidates and gave you the inside story and how the issues evolved, and they became bestsellers. And when I was reading one of them, I noticed on the inside front cover, it said he was also the author of a book called Thunder Out of China. It turned out he'd been in China in the 1940s, covering the conflict between the Kuomintang and the communists and giving, a very detailed view of the tumultuous time. And that, again, spurred my interest in China. So when I was an undergraduate in the mid-60s, I started studying Chinese, but I discovered I also liked economics, so I started combining those interests, and that's what I've been doing ever since. I first went to China in 1978.
Yeah, well, that's a long time you're looking at the Chinese economy. So then, you know, during all that time, you know, what would you say have been some of the most sort of formative experiences or events that have really sort of shaped and colored your perspective then of China?
Well, a few things. I was fortunate enough to be able to be involved with the World Bank and some of the important conferences they had on shaping economic reform, dealing with reformers. A major conference that occurred in Dalian up in the Northeast in 1992. But I think one of my most memorable experiences were when I met with and came to know a little bit Zhu Rongji. We were together at a conference in Hawaii. I can't even remember. I could figure out what it was, but it doesn't really matter. We were early to the breakfast area each day, so I started talking to him, and then one morning he came in and said, I just got the call last night. I'm going to be the next mayor of Shanghai. That was before he came onto the national stage. And then it was fantastic interacting with him in subsequent years when he became vice premier and they ultimately took over the governorship of the central bank and was shaping China's dealing with inflation and monetary policy issues. And he was marvelous to argue with and talk with. He would challenge anything he heard that he thought didn't make sense. And it was always a very good give and take. It's unlike anything else I've experienced with other Chinese leaders.
Mm. And of course, SOE reform was a big part of what he drove through as well.
A very big part. And when people say, this is really an intractable problem, you have to go back and look at what happened in the late 1990s when the state sector was substantially transformed. Hard budget constraints were imposed for a while. Some of the firms went out of existence. Some of them were taken over by management. You know, roughly 30 million people lost their jobs, and they were able to deal with that, so they didn't have much evidence of social unrest.
And that brings us to the substance of your book. So your most recent book is called The State Strikes Back, which is a very neat and evocative title. Your previous book from 2014, also with a very nice title, was called Markets Over Mao, where basically you ran an argument that China's success was not some magical combination of state capitalism, but rather that it had gradually ceded ground to the market and to the private sector over time. But given this very big change in the titling of your books, obviously something very big has had occurred in the last 5 years or so. So can you just run us through what was the argument in Markets Over Mao, and why is it now the state strikes back?
Well, I thought the evidence was pretty overwhelming that the success China had after 1978 was primarily due to the increased importance of the market, not that China, as you said, had some magic concoction of state capitalism. Price formation changed. We had almost all prices determined by supply and demand in the market, which was a huge change. You had a legal framework created for the development of private enterprises. You had private enterprises becoming much more efficient, displacing state companies across very broad swaths of the economy. They became the dominant source of investment, and they also became, after 2000, a very important source of export. So the state sector was fading away on most metrics, and the share of GDP produced by the private sector grew to be maybe roughly two-thirds. And particularly on employment, if you look at employment, almost all the growth of employment in the modern sector, I mean non-agriculture, after 1978, came in the private sector. So growth of output, growth of employment, growth of investment, growth of exports was all being generated predominantly in the private sector in a very market-driven economy. Lots of, not much evidence of monopolistic power. It was a, highly competitive market, and that was enhanced, even to begin with, in part by accident, because under the Maoist years, every province was trying to develop its own self-sufficient industrial structure. So when you began to have a market economy and drove down interregional barriers, which happened starting in the 70s, in the 80s, you had kind of already set up a very competitive market because you had lots and lots of players in most industries. And that was only enhanced by the reforms that got China into the WTO, the reduction of tariffs, the elimination of import quotas and licensing requirements. So I thought it was competition that was driving this rapid growth.
Okay, so now it's the state strikes back. I think many people following China and the Chinese economy would note there has been this resurgence both in the state and the economy, but also in terms of political control as well, and that's very closely associated with Xi Jinping as well. What I like in your book, though, is of course you try and put some as hard an evidence as there can be around exactly what's been happening. So what are the sort of key data points that you're looking at to show what exactly has happened over the last several years?
Well, maybe I should begin by saying somebody like Richard McGregor would probably advise me, and other people have advised me, I should have made the title "The Party State Strikes Back," because it's the state is not a separate actor, obviously, in the Chinese system, and obviously, as you look across many domains, it's the party that's reasserting its role in so many areas. But I wanted to stick more on the economic side, and since that's technically at least more directly under the state, I decided to use this title, "The State Strikes Back." What are the indicators? Well, many of them are the inverse of the things that I just mentioned. Credit began to flow overwhelmingly to state companies starting very shortly after the time Xi Jinping came into power. And I think it was partly due to the fact that he kept talking and kept admonishing everybody that state companies needed to be bigger. And whereas in the earlier years, only about a third of credit was going to state companies, by 2016, over 80% of the credit from the banking system was flowing to state companies, and the private sector was getting squeezed out. In the earlier period, the share of private investment was rapidly rising, but as credit flowed more to state companies, the relative growth of state investment picked up, and by the last couple of years, the share of investment being undertaken by private firms is actually going down. And this despite the fact that the productivity of state companies throughout this period was actually declining. So even as their return on assets was going down and falling to a level of about a third of that of private companies, they were getting more and more credit. They were not becoming more credit-worthy on any traditional metric. But I think what happened under Xi Jinping is the sometimes existing, you know, implicit guarantee of lending to state companies was substantially strengthened. So the bank view was, well, there's a guarantee, the risk is zero, we want to make the state companies bigger. So very quickly, the overwhelming share of credit was flowing to state companies. So those were some of the some of the things that changed in the last 5 or 6 years. And obviously, Made in China 2025 would have to be on that list. Remember, there was, I mean, it's not as if they never had any industrial policy before Xi Jinping came to Beijing. Obviously, they did. In 2010, they had this thing called, I can't remember the name of it, the Strategic Emerging Industries Initiative, which was a state-driven industrial policy. But there was a lot of foreign objection, and firms were objecting to it. Governments were protesting that it was unfair to state to private and foreign companies. And it was substantially modified. I don't want to say it was abandoned, but I think the sense I get from talking to people in the business community is that once they adjusted it, they felt they did have some opportunity to participate in the areas that were identified. But Made in China 2025 was a doubling down, at least, on that earlier initiative. It covered more sectors. It had a much stronger mechanism for financing the development of things like artificial intelligence and supercomputers and so forth. And even though the hue and cry has been coming from all kinds of Western governments and companies, the Chinese have not really backed down from it. They haven't really changed it substantially. They've dialed back the rhetoric. You know, apparently a directive went out that you can't talk about Made in China 2025 anymore, so you don't read about it. But it's still there. They still have dozens of so-called government guidance funds that are tasked with pouring money into these priority areas. So I think industrial policy is another thing. It's not that it didn't exist before, but it was, shall we say, less ambitious than what we see today.
And so, and why do you think this is occurring, though?
Well, I think my basic view is that it goes back to Xi Jinping and his drive for political control. He wants to have a bigger state sector. He endorsed a very wide-reaching, far-ranging economic reform program in November of 13, but not very much of it was ever implemented. And shortly after that, he kept talking about how state companies have to be bigger. So the program in the fall of 13 said that the market must be the decisive force in the allocation of resources, but the rhetoric switched very quickly to talking about how state companies need to be made bigger. They're not getting, you know, he wasn't saying they should get bigger for success and higher returns and reinvestment of their profits. You know, he was relying on state-directed credit to make them bigger. But they became much less efficient.
Do you think China faces a kind of binary choice between political control and economic liberalization, and therefore, in your telling, a choice between political control and growth?
Well, I think it's a continuum. I think there's a continuous trade-off. I think we're near an extreme now where political control has been very heavily emphasized, even at the expense of economic growth, because Xi thinks it gives him more control. But he, you know, at some point in the future, he might change his mind, make a different choice if growth slows down enough. And I think that is what is likely to happen. I think I started out this research trying to answer the question, you know, what's medium-term potential growth? And to answer that, I thought, well, first I have to understand how they went from double-digit growth down to the 6-point whatever it is today. And I think about half the decline was due to the drag of state companies. So at some point, he could decide that growth has slowed too much. We can't deliver improvements in healthcare and education and rising wages and so forth if we continue to slow down. So he could dial back and introduce more market-oriented reforms and give up some of the political control that he thinks he's gaining through a big state sector. I don't see much evidence that that's happening anytime soon, but it could emerge. Depends to some extent on what happens, not only what happens to the economy, but what happens to the leadership. is Xi Jinping going to get his third five-year term, or, you know, will that not materialize? They've amended the Constitution so he can continue to hold office, but I don't see deeply enough into the decision-making process to understand what the actual process will be by which he is able to exercise this option.
For people watching this and watching what happens, so the dynamic is that, okay, if growth slows too much, then maybe they would be compelled to do some of the reforms that you think they need to do, which is largely to wind back some of the shift towards the state. You know, for a lot of people, though, there's always a lot of noise about those official GDP numbers, right, and whether or not they should be even trusted at all. And so people are saying, oh, okay, the official GDP number is around 6-point-something% right now, but then you'll constantly see in the newspapers, oh, the real number was really only 2% or negative. Some academic has done an estimate. So tell us, as someone who knows the Chinese economy in and out, what's your sort of view of the official GDP number, and how should we be thinking about these things or interpreting things?
Well, I think the quality of Chinese data varies quite a bit depending on what domain you're in, but I think the GDP numbers are generally accurate. I wouldn't place a huge emphasis on whatever's to the right of the decimal place. There was a Chinese critic of GDP numbers, I can't remember, it was late last year. He insisted that the growth rate was 2.67%. I thought, well, anybody who thinks he has any idea about what the growth rate is at the hundredth of a percentage point, you know, has zero credibility. I don't care what the number is to the left. So some of these claims you can not take too seriously. Well, the one thing I look at is when people are talking about a very, very sharp slowdown, the first thing I start looking at is, well, what's happening to imports? If imports, you know, if the economy is really decelerating rapidly, you should see a very substantial deceleration in imports. Because there are a lot of factors that feed into the growth of imports, but the most important is the growth of domestic income. And on the occasions where people have argued that, you know, growth is rapidly decelerating, and I look at the data and say, you know, well, actually import growth is up a little bit over what it was last year. And so I tend, you know, you could kind of triangulate and look at other data, and the import data and the trade data in general has been proven to be quite reliable. Various times people have, you know, looked at all the trading partner data to see if it's congruent with what the Chinese are reporting on imports and exports, and generally it lines up pretty well. And it's not that hard to measure trade. You know, it's you're not dealing with complicated questions like what's the value of imputed rent that should be going into GDP and other challenges. So that's certainly one way you can check. I'll make just one final point, which I've made in the earlier book about markets over Mao, and that is that on every metric that I've ever been able to find, whether it's growth, return on sales, return on assets, credit worthiness, and so forth, and I've used these metrics over and over again, private firms look better than state firms. Well, if the state statistical authorities were cooking all the data, why have they done so in a way that makes state companies look so bad? So I think they're doing the best they can with fairly limited resources, and it's not to say that they don't do some smoothing, maybe, you know, but the IMF has looked into this. When growth accelerates, the official numbers may be understating growth. When it decelerates, it may be slightly overstating growth. But their view is that over the long term, the average of the official numbers over any multi-year period tends to be pretty close to the real performance.
I mean, in general, one might get the sense that it's a fairly pessimistic story so far. But actually, your book does have an optimistic angle to it in the sense that you're kind of contrarian to a number of others that out there who think that China's slowing is kind of, in a sense, natural or in some sense inevitable. Your argument is that's not the case. Can you quickly sort of tell us why that is?
Yeah, I think there's a very predominant view. Well, China's grown so fast for so long, and it's inevitable they're going to slow down. The base is bigger. You can't keep growing at double digits forever. You know, Larry Summers with Lance Pritchard at Harvard has put out a study 5 or 6 years ago in which they looked globally for all the cases they could find of what they called super rapid economic growth. I don't remember exactly what their criteria were, but it's something like growth of at least 6% per capita for more than 6 years. And they only found, I think they found about 35 or 40 episodes of where countries had had this very, very rapid economic growth. And they found that the most predominant statistical regularity was eventually these countries slowed, and they all slowed to about 2%. So they forecast that China is going to slow to 2%. It's grown faster for longer than any of the other countries in their sample, so they're overdue for a slowdown. But I think their analysis really didn't take into account how poor China is and how far they are from the frontier of, you know, Western economies in terms of per capita income. They're only at about 25%. And when Taiwan, Korea, South Korea, Japan grew rapidly, they started at about 25%. And in the case of South Korea and Taiwan, they ended at about 50% of the U.S. level. In the case of Japan, I think it was something closer to 70% of the U.S. level. So if you believe in this convergence hypothesis, at least the potential is there for China to get way above where it currently is at 25%. Now, convergence is not automatic, I don't think, and certainly we've seen around the world that most countries or most emerging markets and developing countries are not converging rapidly to the frontier. So it takes the right mix of policies and so forth in order to capture the potential. So I think the potential is there for China to grow at, you know, roughly 8%, maybe a little more, for probably another 2 decades. Well, so that's the bad news of my study is the state is dragging down economic growth. The good news is if they adopted more market-oriented policies, they might grow faster than they currently are.
One thing that could throw a spanner in the works of that catch-up model, and I just sort of want to bridge across to the trade war now, right, with the United States and China. And of course, but just linking it to the catch-up model of growth, of course, trade is extremely important to that model of growth. So is absorbing technology from overseas. Both these things are now under a threat as part of this sort of economic tensions with the United States. So I want to draw you in a little bit on that, even though I know it's not in the book. You know, what do you think is going on between the U.S. and China right now? How do you think both sides are seeing it?
Well, I think what may have appeared initially to be a dispute primarily about trade and investment practices has obviously morphed into something far more significant, and you can see it in the escalation of demands from the U.S. side. You know, initially President Trump was predominantly preoccupied with getting the Chinese to sign up to buy more U.S. products, whether soybeans or aircraft or LNG or something like this that would bring down the deficit, which is something that has animated him, you know, long before he became president. But there are other people in the administration who think that we should be focusing on some of the structural issues, protection of intellectual property and technology transfer. And then at another extreme or further extreme, there are those who think China really does pose an existential threat. And we see this articulated very plainly and openly in some of the official documents. And we see it, I think, most obviously in the case of a speech that Vice President Pence gave at the Hudson Institute last year. And I think there are some people in this camp who, you know, are in favor of what is sometimes called decoupling. And that's fairly widely supported. Last year, the Congress passed and President Trump signed 2 important pieces of legislation, one which will potentially tighten up on the review of inbound investments, particularly in the technology space, and another which will have lead to the first major overhaul of our export control regime in many decades. Now, the details of the latter are not are still being worked out by the people that are building up these lists of emerging and so-called emerging and foundational technologies that will require a license. So there are 2 issues. You know, how extensive is this list going to be, and how many licenses are going to be granted when a company wants to sell something to China? But potentially these could be very, very restrictive, and as we've seen, in the case of ZTE earlier and now in the case of Huawei, this can substantially slow the development of some of China's most successful economies and perhaps even keep them from moving up the technology ladder. I'm not sure that this can be a successful strategy in the long run, but it might be a successful strategy in the short or medium term. So I think we've moved from a kind of focus on the bilateral deficit to a broader set of structural issues. And now I think what we're seeing emerge, at least if I was sitting in China, I would come to the conclusion, you know, this isn't really about tariffs and trade. It's about the effort of the United States to contain China economically.
If we go, just go back one step, I mean, you've posited three different drivers of the trade war. One is basically Trumpian sort of objectives around the trade deficit, which most economists basically dismiss as not making much sense and solvable if to an extent with China just agreeing to buy more stuff and as part of a deal, even though it won't necessarily reduce the trade deficit per se. The two other elements, though, was the structural issues and then the geopolitical tensions. On the structural issues, though, it's quite a long list of complaints the U.S. has. I mean, what do you think about the currency of those complaints? Do you think they make sense? Which ones make sense? Which ones don't make sense? Which ones are overblown?
Well, I think there's an element in all these areas that's relevant and should be addressed, but I think the most overblown one is the technology transfer, the forced technology transfer. Obviously, there are cases of this, but I think they have diminished dramatically over the last couple of decades. And the reason's very simple. Initially, if you were a multinational and wanted to invest in China, you had to do so in the form of a joint venture. And the technology that you brought to the table was part of your capital contribution. It was valued, and your share of the profits was then a function in part of the technology that you provided. And I think most companies were entering into these transactions voluntarily. They did not want to come to China and compete on the basis of Chinese technology, certainly. They thought their technology would give them an advantage in the market, and they were required to have a joint venture, which means the Chinese partner had access to the technology. But today, about three-quarters of all direct investment going into China is in the form of wholly owned foreign companies. So there is no domestic partner, and there is no sharing of technology. Now, that doesn't mean that some of your employees might download your good stuff and sell it off to somebody else, you know, pure theft. But that can happen anywhere. So multinational companies, I think, today are in a position to protect their intellectual property, using the kinds of mechanisms they would use if they were investing in Brazil or in India or any other emerging markets. But if you read the 301 report that came out from our trade representative's office last year, it is filled page after page after page of assertions about forced technology transfer. So I think it's a problem, but it's a diminished problem. And my view on this is supported by there's an organization in the United States called the U.S.-China Business Council, which has about 200 corporate members, many of them quite large, many of them doing business in China for decades. And they do an annual survey. I mean, what are your problems? They ask a lot of questions. How much money are you making, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the questions always is, what are the greatest obstacles that you're facing? So they have a list every year. Problems of technology transfer are number 7 on the list. Number 1 is regulatory problems, arbitrary, unforeseen changes in the regulatory environment that affect the industry that they're operating in that adversely affect their profits and ability to operate. They don't have any way of effectively lobbying to get a change in the regulation. So that's, and there are a bunch of other things, but there are some foreign firms, of course, for which, technology transfer probably is number 1, but if you take the whole universe, it's not seen as the major problem they're facing. Whereas if you look at the 301 report that came out of the trade representative's office, you would think that was the only thing that's driving the friction between the United States and China.
And do you see that as solvable, the so-called structural issues? Do you see that as something that largely can be solved if the two parties are willing?
I think it's very difficult because the negotiators on the U.S. side, which, by the way, don't talk to industry. You talk to the industry people, they say the negotiators don't talk to them very much about what, you know, what's going on, what they're asking for. The Chinese insist there isn't much forced technology transfer, and now they passed a new law, which, you know, they say, well, we never did it anyway, but now we'll pass a law against it. So I think there's a fairly large gulf. I think it can be solved most easily by getting rid of the remaining areas in which a joint venture is required. And the Chinese are moving in that direction. They're now allowing majority foreign-owned and within a few years wholly foreign-owned financial institutions. So in securities, asset management, insurance, and so forth, it will soon be possible to have a 100% foreign-owned firm. In the automobile industry, which they've always required 50-50 joint ventures, Tesla has its license to have a wholly foreign-owned company, and they say for, you know, conventional internal combustion engines, the requirement for a joint venture will be lifted. I can't remember in 2021 or, you know, a foreseeable step. And a company like BMW has already negotiated with its partner to increase its ownership share to 75%. They paid $2.4 billion U.S. dollars. So I think they've structured the transaction. My understanding it is it can't actually be fully consummated until 2021 or whenever this regulation changes. But they're going to get control. They're going to be the controlling shareholder. And maybe, you know, after some additional period of time, they'll buy out the rest, the remaining share of their domestic partner. So BMW could be operating a wholly foreign. So I think that's the certainly one way of reducing this problem is to reduce and hopefully eliminate all of the requirements for joint ventures.
So there are some potential solutions on the structural side of things, but not necessarily everywhere, depending on the expectations. And as you said, there's a gulf. What about then on the technology angle now, the newest set of measures, the inward investment controls, the export controls, the actions against Huawei and other firms? Do you see these things as things that could ever be up for a negotiation and therefore either full or partial solutions? And if not, do you agree with this view that then we're heading for some sort of deeper bifurcation?
Well, I hope they'd be up for a negotiation, and I think we'll just have to wait and see. As I indicated earlier, I think there's some division within the U.S. administration about what the ultimate objective is. Is it to level the playing field on trade and investment, or is it to try to contain China's economic rise? And I think the way some of these things unfold will, you know, give us a partial answer to what, you know, what the real underlying objective is. And then the next question would be, well, in a subsequent administration, would the objective be modified or changed? I mean, all those things are very, very uncertain.
Okay, we might, I might ask one last question, and then we'll go to the audience for questions. So please get ready with your questions. So my last question would just be, how vulnerable do you see the Chinese economy in the sort of near term, right, in the immediate situation in terms of the pressure coming from tariffs, these sorts of things?
It's a complicated question. I think one has to begin by recognizing that China's dependence on the external sector has diminished substantially over the last decade. If you go back to the 2000s up to around 2007, 2008, their trade surplus, their current account surplus, was growing by leaps and bounds. It hit about 9% of GDP by 2007. And for those of you who can remember back to the 80s when Japan was having a big imbalance, a big surplus at the peak, the Japanese current account surplus, I believe, and Richard would correct me if I don't have the right number in mind, but it was something like 3.4%, which at the time was, you know, seemingly unfathomable that a country could be running this big a global current account surplus, but, you know, China's was almost three times bigger. So this gave a big boost to economic growth because they were exporting a lot more than they were importing. But since 2007, that current account surplus has basically gone down to zero. It was 0.4% last year. So that's one metric. There, in fact, from 2007 on, as I indicated earlier, that you know when your surplus starts shrinking, it means you're importing more than you're exporting. And so your domestic demand is growing more slowly than domestic demand is growing more slowly because a lot of your demand is being satisfied by imports compared to exports. So that's one metric. The second metric is simply looking at exports to GDP, and China's exports to GDP, I don't remember the exact numbers. It hasn't fallen quite by half, but it's fallen by something like 40%, something in the mid-30s or so, or low-30s down to something in the 20s. And the third metric is that China's share of global trade has come down from 2001 up until around 2015 or so. China's share of global trade increased, and particularly its share of global exports expanded year after year after year. But in the last, roughly the last 3 years, their share of global exports has come down. So they're less trade dependent than they used to be. I don't think that's something that's been fully factored into the thinking of policymakers in Washington. I think to some extent they have a somewhat older mindset that, you know, China's highly dependent on exports, so if we can slow their exports down, their economy is going to collapse. Well, it will slow down. There are lots of different estimates out there of how much this might be. I think if Trump expands the tariffs to the products that have not been put on, had special tariffs put on, and it stays at 25% for any significant period of time, it could slice a percentage point off China's economic growth. So instead of growing at 6 point something, they could be growing at 5 point something. I think they have some flexibility to further offset part of that by having more tax cuts of the type that they introduced earlier this year. I don't think they can fully offset it. But I don't think China's going to fall apart if they're growing at 5 point something instead of 6 point something. And I think if Trump puts the tariffs on the remaining 300 and some billion, that support for tariffs in the United States is going to erode very, very rapidly, because U.S. consumers have not paid much of a price for the tariffs that have been levied so far, because they have gone overwhelmingly on intermediate goods that are used in the production process. Within the United States, those intermediates constitute only part of the value of the final product. Not all of it gets passed through, although a lot of it does. But the things that have been exempt from tariffs so far have been things like toys, footwear, apparel, and consumer electronics. None of those are intermediates. Those are all consumer goods. And most of the 25% tariffs is going to get passed through to consumers. A possible exception is iPhones, because Apple makes so much money, maybe they could cut their profit margin somewhat and absorb part of the 25% tariff on their products, which are made almost exclusively in China. So consumers will be well aware of these. They've been oblivious to the tariffs up until now, but if the broader tariffs go through, I think they will soon be quite aware of the higher prices that they're paying. And if there's no trade agreement and our deficit continues to expand, as it has since the trade war began, the obvious question that will be raised, it's already being raised in some quarters, but it will be raised more widely, is, you know, what are we getting out of this trade dispute with China? You know, Trump, you know, said famously at the beginning, these trade wars are easy to win. Yes, there may be a little pain at the beginning, but the benefits are going to be so munificent that, you know, it'll all be worth it. So people will be seeing a lot of pain, and there will be no gain in sight. So I think I'm trying to make a comparison. I think China can withstand somewhat lower rate of growth. I don't think Trump will get reelected if these tariffs are on a very broad range of consumer goods, and he can't point to any gains.
Yep. I'm sure Trump would consider it very patriotic of Apple to absorb those costs and not pass them on. maybe we'll go to the floor. Angus over there. Just state your name and your affiliation.
Sure. Angus Nicholson, AMP Capital. Thanks for that. I had a quick question on sort of your statement there around the amount of share that state-owned companies are taking of on-balance sheet lending. And we've sort of seen private companies really struggle to get credit, particularly in the wake of the crackdown on off-balance sheet lending. So just wondering the sort of key reforms that you think would be necessary to restructure the capital allocation problem in China to get more credit to the more productive private sector enterprises?
Well, the premise of your question is absolutely correct. I mean, private companies initially were losing access to bank credit. Then within a year or two, the Chinese government decided there were too many, you know, credit to GDP was too high, there were a lot of risks, and so they started cutting back. And the cutbacks came primarily in so-called shadow banking, which had become a major source of credit for private firms. So they were kind of hit with a double whammy, and that's one of the things that has led to much slower growth on the part of private firms. How do you get rid of this? Well, the Chinese have already tried a couple of things. I don't want to go into all the nitty-gritty details, but they haven't produced much results to date. The central bank regulators started taking steps to improve the allocation of credit to private firms at the beginning of 2018, so more than a year ago, but not much has happened. Then Guo Shuqing, the regulator, the bank and insurance regulator chairman, gave some speeches in which he said banks should strive to make 30% of their loans to private companies. So there's been some window guidance or jawboning, as we would call it in the United States, to try to get more credit allocated to private firms. I'm a skeptic. I think this is basically window dressing and a waste of time. As long as there is a practically explicit 100% guarantee on lending to state companies, banks have no incentive to lend to private companies. On average, private companies may be a lot more creditworthy, and I think they are. But if the credit risk of lending to a state company is zero because of this implicit guarantee, I think banks will continue to lend overwhelmingly to state companies. So I think what they've got to do is get rid of that guarantee. They can start slowly. They can allow some state companies to go bankrupt, in which banks have to absorb the loss out of their own profits and, you know, get reflected on their earnings. That could start to send a message that, hey, we're not guaranteeing these loans anymore. It's already happened to some extent on bond issuance, but most of the bonds that have defaulted have been issued by private players. So I think we need to have a process that eliminates this implicit guarantee on lending to state companies, and then banks would have to start doing a more serious allocation of credit worthiness. Keep in mind, 40% of all state companies lose money year after year after year. None of them go out of business. They just keep borrowing more money. And there are almost no bankruptcies. And the number of state companies, you know, even though their contribution to GDP is nowhere near what it once was, the number of state companies continues to go up. And in the slowdown and restriction on the flow of credit to private companies, a lot of private companies have disappeared. They've either been taken over by state companies or they've gone out of business.
Thank you, Michael Ahrens. Just to follow on that point, because in relation to SOEs, the reading I got was some examples of how these SOEs stood up to the government because they've become so powerful. And this must, with this flow of credit, maybe they're becoming even more powerful in the structure against Beijing. The example was given of Beijing's wanting the oil companies to produce less, more clean fuel. And the oil company said, well, okay, but it's going to cost you all this money. This could cause instability. And they backed off. Now, the chances of this government, this Beijing, present government allowing any SOE to go bust seems to be even more remote. They're going to become fatter, aren't they?
Well, I agree with the premise of your question. There are a number of state companies that are extremely powerful and can shape policy and can thwart the implementation of policy that they find objectionable for one reason or another, and certainly the upstream oil and gas companies would be high on any such list of companies. State Grid, which is the dominant distributor of electric power over about three-quarters of China's landscape, is another one. It's not a listed company. There's no transparency. They've resisted many attempts to reform the way, you know, electric power is priced and distributed. So this is part of the landscape. And, you know, maybe it's also a partial explanation of why Xi Jinping's not undertaking reform. And a lot of it would be anathema to these big, powerful state companies. I mean, there's a paradox here. I've emphasized that he wants political control, but an alternative hypothesis would be he's really a dyed-in-the-wool reformer. He's just can't wait to get it done, but all the bad guys are standing in his path. But the paradox is that all the political scientists are telling us that he's the most powerful leader since Deng Xiaoping and maybe since Mao. Well, if he's so powerful, then why can't he override the preferences of a handful of big state-owned companies? Why doesn't the organization department, you know, fire all these guys and put in new leadership that's more amenable to the kinds of reform? So I kind of go back and forth, but I find a little bit more persuasive the idea that that it's the desire for political control rather than the opposition of vested interests that's slowing down or stalling reform. But they're not completely mutually exclusive.
You mentioned the declining relative share of exports, and particularly in the last 3 years. To what extent is that attributable to Xi's program of sort of pointing the capital towards the state enterprises and them not being as competitive in creating exports for the economy? Because obviously, if so, that'd be a pretty explicit cost of his program.
Well, it could be. It could be a significant factor because, as I mentioned earlier, the private firms became the dominant source of export growth. They don't produce over half of exports, but if you look at incremental exports on an annual basis over the last 6 or 7 years, private firms have dominated. And you know, it could be with the loss of access to working capital and so forth that their ability to continue to play that large role has been somewhat impaired. But I'm a little, I don't think that's fully satisfactory, though, because we do not see yet that the state share of exports is going up. It's declined to around 11% from 90% years ago, but it's been at around 11% for the last few years. But that's a lagging indicator. I haven't seen the data. You know, it comes out with some lags, so it could be that the state share has ticked up a little bit. That may be part of it. Here you are, Richard.
Thank you, Nick. As you say, the figure of Xi Jinping sort of hovers over all of this. There's innumerable examples of how he supported rhetorically and in policy the state sector. Late last year, the last 6 months of last year, when the economy was slowing, not dramatically, but probably slowing, he convened a whole bunch of meetings with entrepreneurs, including at the Great Hall of the People, and sort of spoke, you know, very lovingly of their contribution to China. What did you make of that? I mean, maybe he is going to be a little bit more pragmatic than we've given him credit for, and he realizes he needs the private sector to bolster the party.
I agree. It may be a year or two from now when we look back and can see more clearly exactly what was going on and what's changed. We may think of the second half of 2018 as a turning point. Certainly these meetings with private sector entrepreneurs were highly publicized and, could lead to some substantial change over time. But I'm a show me guy. I want to see what the result is. And through the first quarter of this year, the output of private industrial enterprises still lags substantially behind that of state companies. So remember, if you look over a 20-year period, private companies were growing twice as fast as state companies in the industrial sector. Then starting in 17 and 18, state growth picked up, private growth continued to moderate. And so we've had a couple of years in which state firms, for the first time in eons, are growing more rapidly than private firms. I think part of it is that private firms haven't been able to get the capital, but part of it could also be uncertainty. You know, on the one hand, yes, she has these highly publicized meetings in which she's praising private firms to the skies. On the other hand, he's insisting that they all have to have party committees that not exactly clear what they're actually going to do. But if you're a private entrepreneur and have a lot of your wealth invested in a company that you started and ran to be very successful, it's hard to imagine that you would think having a party committee kind of overlooking your shoulder is something that you've been looking forward to for all these years.
Sign of success.
So another reason, and I can't separate, and you know, maybe another reason that you know private investment has slowed down is that these entrepreneurs are further diversifying their wealth. You know, they're buying another house in Sydney instead of expanding their business because they're not sure what's going to happen as the role of the party continues to be enhanced. So I think the slowdown in the growth of the private sector, the slowdown in their access to credit, the slowdown in their share of investment is some combination of the squeezing out, which I've mentioned, and the political uncertainty that has accompanied this campaign to establish party committees even in private firms. So I'm not sure he can have it both ways, to tell them that they're highly valued and we hope you can continue your good work, and oh, by the way, just to be sure, we're gonna have a party committee in your business. I think it's a little bit early to know exactly what these party committees are going to do. I've heard some people say that once the party committee gets established, they see how successful the firm is, and when the local governments are trying to interfere, the party committees push them away and try to preserve the ability of the private firm to operate as they see fit. I don't know whether these anecdotes are reflective of a general pattern or whether they're outliers.
Hi, two quick questions. Firstly, are you aware of any economic reformists who currently have any influence in the party or the government? And secondly, recently it was reported that in the trade deal negotiations, the Chinese backtracked on a lot of their commitments. And do you have any idea or insight into why that happened? Thanks.
Well, I certainly don't have any insights into the nature of decision-making at the very top of the Chinese political system. Some people think Liu He is a very committed economic reformer. I've met with him. He came to the Peterson Institute the first time 4 or 5 years ago, and I've met with him 3 or 4 times since. And he is not very transparent, which is not surprising. If you're the chief advisor to the leading political figure, you're probably not going to be advertising what your policy recommendations are. So he may be giving very strong pro-reform advice, but I don't think we have any way, certainly I don't have any way of knowing whether or not that's the case. He certainly has some very strong reformers around him. I'm struck, and this goes back to the negotiation between China and the United States on trade, that whenever I see a picture of Liu He in Washington with his negotiating team, or sometimes the pictures are in Beijing, that Yi Gang, the governor of the central bank, is standing right next to him. Well, he's not there because he's the governor of the central bank. He's probably there primarily because he is a valued advisor to Liu He, and he is also, I can't remember exactly, I think he's vice chairman of the leading small group on finance and economics, or one of these specialized party groups. And he's certainly a very strong reformer. He's very much in the same vein as Governor Zhou. He's been trying to push China to have more flexible exchange rate and liberalization of interest rates and all kinds of other things to improve, you know, letting greater foreign participation in the financial sector. So some of those people are certainly, in evidence. What influence they're having on Xi Jinping's thinking is very hard to know. I mean, we have an analogous problem in the United States. You know, Mr. Trump has said repeatedly that the tariffs are being paid by the Chinese, and it's bringing in billions and billions of dollars of revenue to the U.S. government. And the first time he said this, he must have been misquoted. He couldn't possibly have said that. Well, he has said it more and more times. And so my view is, if Larry Kudlow, his top economic advisor, cannot disabuse him of this idea, or doesn't care to try to disabuse him of this idea, you know, what hope do we have for rational economic policy making in Washington?
That's a good question. Maybe on the far left over here.
Paul Myers, Independent. I was interested in your views on the Belt and Road Initiative and how that might cast light on what's going on vis-a-vis the state sector and the private sector.
My knowledge of the Belt and Road program is not very deep, but I certainly have some opinions. It certainly does feed in to some of the expansion of the state sector, because the major beneficiaries, at least as far as I can tell, are the 10 largest state engineering and construction corporations that are getting most of the contracts, whether it's to build a power plant, a road, a rail line, a dam. Almost all this infrastructure is under the aegis of these big state companies. On the other hand, I'm not sure they're so inefficient. This may be a domain in which, you know, they've already built massive amounts of infrastructure in record time, in many cases, and under budget, and seemingly quite successful. So these may be among the more efficient state firms. Then the other question related to that is, does this affect the flow of lending to state companies? I don't think it does, because the data that I'm looking at on, you know, the redirection towards state-owned credit is the share of credit, which has gone, I think I mentioned, from, you know, around a third to over 80% to state-owned companies. That's a percentage of lending to state non-financial companies in RMB. And most of the Belt and Road projects are being financed by loans to foreign governments or to foreign corporations that are, you know, quasi-state companies that are undertaking the projects. And they may, in turn, give the contract to a Chinese construction company. But I don't think it's distorting the lending data on what the share is state versus private. The other thing I would think is worth noting, and this is one of my little pet peeves, people always talk about how much China is investing in the Belt and Road, and that the short correction is that they are investing almost nothing. They are lending a lot of money, and maybe they'll be investing once the loans default, but at least up front, they're not investing. The statistical authorities a couple of months ago, when they gave their report on outbound foreign direct investment by China and Chinese entities, the amount of investment in Belt and Road projects was $15 billion. So it's very, very small. You know, people talk about $1 trillion going into Belt and Road over a period of several years. Well, if the investment component is only $15 billion a year, it's vanishingly small.
But that's all we have time for. So everyone just join me in thanking Nick for fielding so many great questions.